It's great to be back on the saddle, isn't it? Everyone can hear me now, right? It's great to see everyone. I think we're going to have a very productive upcoming session. And we've got a great opportunity today to kick it off because we're going to be talking about an issue that's very important to the state of Florida as it relates to invasive species. We're going to have two presentations today, and we'll begin with Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, of which we'll be recognizing Melissa Tucker, who is the director of the Division of Habitat and Species Conservation. Mrs. Tucker, you are recognized.
And I am Melissa Tucker, the director for the Division of Habitat and Species Conservation with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to you today about the invasive fish and wildlife in Florida and FWC's role in helping to manage those. So invasive species are a concern across the state because they can have a negative impact on our native fish and wildlife, our environment, and our economy. There are more than 500 non-native species that have been reported in Florida, although not all of these are representing a reproducing and established population. One of the reasons that invasive species do so well in our state is because of our subtropical climate. Many of our established species do come from tropical regions of the world, and when they're released here in the state, they're able to establish and thrive. The impacts of invasive species can be substantial as well. On the ecological front, invasive species can drive declines in native species through competition with those natives, habitat alteration, and direct depredation of them. They also bring in diseases and parasites. Some invasive species cause impacts to human health and to safety. Quantifying the economic cost of invasive species can be very difficult. A United Nations report that was published earlier this year estimated $423 billion spent annually worldwide combating invasive species across the globe. Another study that was published earlier in the year estimated a $1.2 trillion cost of invasive species over the last 30 years, and that those costs are equivalent to major storms like hurricanes and earthquakes worldwide. FWC approaches invasive species in several ways. Preventing a species from becoming established is the most cost-effective option. Once a species is detected in the state, we shift to control and to management. There are a wide variety of tools that are available to us, and ongoing research helps us to refine and assess our management approaches and to identify new and innovative tools. Working with partners is critical to successful invasive species management. Coordination with partners extends our knowledge, funding, and expertise to better address the wide array of issues that invasive species bring. Not all non-native species are invasive. An invasive species is one that occurs outside of its native range and causes or is likely to cause ecological or economic harm or harm to human health and safety. There are many non-native species that are present here in the state that are not invasive species. Risk screenings are one of the tools that we use that help us to identify a species that could potentially be a high risk and cause high levels of potential invasion. The process of risk assessment uses biological data about a species along with specific habitat and climate parameters to model the invasion probabilities. This is the information that we then use to help target our management and control options. Enforcement is another key aspect of prevention. FWC officers, along with those from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, monitor our airports and our ports using tools like dogs and X-ray machines to identify when non-native illegal species are moved into the state. Despite our efforts to minimize the chances that an invasive species will enter Florida through our prevention strategies, they may still be introduced into the state. Having citizens that are able to recognize an invasive species and know the risks and how to report it is important. We use a wide variety of education and outreach efforts to increase our citizens' awareness and to help prevent invasive species from becoming established. One program that I'd like to highlight is our Exotic Pet Amnesty Program. If someone has a non-native pet species that they can no longer care for, they can contact us and we'll help them to safely rehome it. Since this program was started in 2006, we've been able to rehome almost 5,000 non-native pets and keep them from being released into the environment. The animals that we receive the most requests for rehoming are non-native reptiles, so species like red-eared slider turtles, ball pythons, sulcata tortoises, boa constrictors, bearded dragons, and green iguanas. Some of our most popular education and outreach activities center around pythons. The Florida Python Challenge is an awareness campaign that's a partnership between the FWC and the South Florida Water Management District. This year's Python Challenge occurred in August and included a 10-day competition that had over 1,000 participants from 35 states and the country of Belgium. Participants were able to remove 209 pythons from South Florida. The Python Challenge and the Youth Python Hunts are sponsored opportunities for people to remove pythons. However, they're really the primary purpose of them is to raise awareness in the interest and the negative impacts of pythons to our native fish and wildlife. The Lionfish Outreach Program was started in 2014 to raise awareness about the impacts of invasive lionfish in Florida waters and to encourage diver involvement in localized control efforts. The 2024 Lionfish Removal and Awareness Day Festival will be on May 18th and 19th in Destin. The program also promotes the consumption and commercial market of lionfish and has a traveling outreach booth, participating in workshops and programs statewide. This includes reaching new audiences with programs such as school lionfish dissections and engaging divers through training on removal techniques. Through our Lionfish Educational Exhibit Program, we work with organizations to create lionfish educational exhibits in public facilities around the state. The goal is to increase awareness and ensure consistent, accurate messaging about lionfish invasion in Florida waters. This collaboration informs the public of potential threats that can result from this invasive species and their role in helping to prevent or minimize these impacts. Our education and awareness activities lead to successfully conducting early detection and rapid response. Citizens that recognize an invasive species play an important role in notifying us and our partners when they identify one. The I've Got One app, along with a call-in number and a website, is a multi-agency tool that citizens can use to report an invasive fish, wildlife, or plant species. The risk assessments that I described earlier have helped us to identify when a species that's reported is a high priority and to mobilize staff to respond. An example of this occurred in August earlier this year when we received a report through our invasive species hotline from a member of the public. They reported a 4 to 5 foot lizard that was burrowing under their home in Orlando. We then received the photos that you see here and identified this as a black-throated monitor. Monitors are a high priority species for us because we know that they have an impact on our native fish and wildlife. Staff were able to mobilize an FWC early detection and rapid response volunteer who went out and humanely captured and killed the individual that you see. So when species have become established, such as with pythons, iguanas, and tegus, our removal efforts focus on identifying areas where the species are impacting our native fish and wildlife. Removal in these areas can mitigate the impacts even when eradication isn't feasible. The removal efforts for Burmese pythons is a joint effort between FWC and the South Florida Water Management District. In 2017, we aligned our programs related to the python contractors, and we worked with our partners to expand the public lands that they could access. This alignment has been incredibly successful. More than half of all the pythons that have been removed from the state were removed after 2017. Tegus have 4 established populations in the state. Since 2012, we've worked with our partners and private landowners and have removed more than 15,000 tegus. Tegus are now established in Georgia and South Carolina, and this is a species that's becoming a regional concern. Green iguanas have also established across many areas of Florida. Again, since 2012, we've worked with partners, removal experts, and private landowners to remove more than 17,500 green iguanas from the wild. And those are the ones that are reported to the agency. There are many individuals as well as municipalities and HOAs that are removing iguanas that are not reporting that information to us. Removal efforts have led to the harvest of more than a million lionfish since 2014. Our largest program directed at removal efforts is the Lionfish Challenge. The 2023 Lionfish Challenge just concluded in October and resulted in a record 30,494 lionfish that were removed. We also had 281 participants, which was a record number and an increase over our 196 participants last year. We also support localized removal efforts by sponsoring organizations that host lionfish derbies. This offers us the opportunity to interact with stakeholders and provide additional outreach opportunities. Some of these competitions also offer prizes for the smallest lionfish to really encourage removing all size classes. Understanding the impact of invasive species and the effectiveness of our efforts to control them are two important questions that research helps us to answer. FWC conducts and funds research to assist us in targeting our control efforts and to develop and use the most effective techniques. For lionfish, adaptive strategies are needed to keep up with the invasion and to encourage more deep water lionfish removal. Most recently, there's been research comparing the effectiveness of different traps in deep water where divers are not able to access them. For pythons, we're also working with the University of Central Florida to test a vehicle-mounted drone and a drone-mounted near-infrared camera system to help us identify pythons that are in the Everglades. We've contracted with the University of Florida to conduct a scout snakes project that will track pythons near very sensitive tree island habitat in the Everglades and help us to identify some of the species that are potentially being impacted there. As I mentioned earlier, partnerships and building stakeholder support are key components of invasive species management. We worked with 15 land managing agencies and organizations to develop the first Florida Python Control Plan. Along with implementing many of the actions that are outlined in the plan, the working group that developed the plan organized a python panel discussion at the North American Invasive Species Management Association conference that was held last November. This included multiple organizations and was a highlight of that conference. We also coordinate extensively outside of the state of Florida to address the many species that occur across state boundaries. One area of coordination is through the National Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force. This provides the federal agency coordination on activities that address aquatic invasive species. The task force is a central point of communication, and they have regional panels that are staffed by experts that help identify issues and set priorities for regional involvement. Our staff are participating in the Gulf and South Atlantic regional panel, which includes 8 states to coordinate efforts and leverage the resources to combat aquatic invasive species throughout the region. Invasive species are a challenging problem in Florida. With our many partners across the state, we continue to focus on preventing the establishment of high-risk species and controlling those that are established to minimize their impact to our native fish and wildlife and our habitats. New innovations do offer some exciting opportunities to expand and enhance our detection and control efforts. We are seeing real successes on many of our public lands with these efforts, and we do appreciate the continued support. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation, Ms. Tucker. Members, do we have questions? Representative Botana.
Thank you, Chair. Just a couple questions, please. Do you have a data that reflects the python growth or any other invasive species on an annual basis? And has there been any increments? And what actions are we working to curtail this invasive species, actually, too? So,
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So we have a project that we're working on now trying to identify the population of pythons that are in the Everglades. I would say that that's a very difficult question because they're a very cryptic species, very hard to detect. And so that's been sort of an ongoing and long-term process for us to figure out the number. We do know that we're seeing increased numbers come out every year. A lot of that has to do with the professionalism of our contractors that are out removing them.
Representative Botani, you have a follow-up? Representative Bartleman.
Chair, may I please ask 2 questions so I can be done?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Okay. So my first question is what can you tell us about your observations in terms of Northwood movement of these species, and because of the climate change and everything that's going on, what are your observations and what's happening?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
Thank you. So we are seeing some species that are appearing further north. I think that, you know, with tegus as an example, that's a species that typically we had seen in further south parts of Florida, but now, like I said, there's some established populations in Georgia, South Carolina, and there's a lot of concern from the regional states from Texas over to South Carolina about the potential for establishment. Tegus have a life history that allows them to burrow, so they probably survive better at cooler temperatures. Things like iguanas, as long as we continue to have cold fronts, there's probably a northward expansion limit on those. We do have concerns about expansion of pythons. There's the potential that we have an additional population that could be developing.
Wow, okay. And then
Representative Varleman.
Thank you, sir. Are there statutes that prevent private citizens from removing any of these animals?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
Thank you. There are not. The only things that a private citizen would need to be aware of is anti-cruelty laws and the need to kill them humanely.
Thank you, Chair.
Ranking Member, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for the presentation. I'm from Boca Raton, South Florida, where we have a major iguana issue. But I'm curious about the outreach, the education for iguana hunters, if you will, and how do we do a better job of making sure that someone who's walking around the neighborhood with what looks like a pellet gun, or we're hoping is a pellet gun, that they know what they're doing. And then the next part of that question is, what is the appropriate disposal of the carcass, and how is that education being delivered, and in both the killing of the iguana and the iguana popsicles?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
Thank you. So I think that one of the things that we would like to work on is working more with some of those private entities that are out doing the iguana control. We have a wealth of resources that are available, and we've provided educational opportunities, but it's something that we need to continue to do on an ongoing basis, because you've got new people that are coming into that arena all the time that we need to continue to work with. And then I think the second part of your question was related to the disposal. Might phone a friend here, but I think we usually recommend that you either bury it or bag the animal and then put it in the trash.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. Despite it being referred to as the chicken of the trees by some communities, I'm not sure we want to start eating them. But in one of your slides, you noted how many iguanas had been removed. And then there was a caveat that those are the ones that have been reported. So how do individuals know to report to you? What is the mechanism for reporting to you? And how does it, do you say, hey, I just killed 10 iguanas on my property and I, you know, put them in the fire pit? Or what is the information that is being reported?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
Thank you. As I mentioned, that we work with a variety of different entities on iguana removal, and so those that we work with regularly are reporting information to us. It's those that are, like I mentioned, new into the arena that we probably need to continue to do additional outreach for, because we would like to know the numbers of what they're removing. And we have the invasives hotline, so they can call and report that there.
And Ms. Tucker, since we're on the subject of iguanas, some of us don't live in South Florida, but perhaps you could give us an idea, just as a committee, the kind of adverse economic impact that they have as it relates to burrowing and infrastructure.
Absolutely. I think that a report from the Palm Beach Post several years ago was their estimate was it cost them $2 million of repair work to levees. Based on the iguana burrowing and the things that were happening in that area. We hear reports very regularly from private citizens who have issues with swimming pool structures, defecation, the eating of their ornamental plants. There's a whole host of things that range from fairly severe and highly detrimental to probably more of an annoyance, but still costly, and something that somebody doesn't want to necessarily have to deal with year in and year out.
Thank you for that. Representative Cassell, for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your presentation. I'm just curious, I know that your presentation focused on animals, and we are going to get another presentation that deals with plants, but doesn't your department also have an invasive plants species program? How, or at one point you did, is it still active?
Ms. Tucker?
Yes, we do have invasive aquatic plant management and upland plant management, and they are both active.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Alvarez, you're recognized.
Hi, ma'am, how are you? Thank you for coming. This summer, I got to participate in some python hunting. So essentially, I am a python control agent now because I'm qualified. So thank you for that. One of the things that, first off, the effort is incredible and it is not easy. So my hat's off to you guys for trying to manage it and for everyone who actually goes out and does it. It's you got to get your tough guy pants on when you're in the middle of the Everglades and it's dark and things are very creepy. So it's very, very tough. I appreciate you guys. How do we actually get rid of those? I don't remember asking that question, so I apologize for not. How do we actually euthanize those snakes when we capture them?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So it's a two-step process that we always recommend, and that is blunt trauma to the head, and then pithing. So you can use a gun, but you have to always follow up with the second process, which is the pithing, to immediately render the brain activity.
And so this
follow-up.
Thank you, sir. Forgive me. We're getting used to it again. And that's something a civilian contractor would do?
Ms. Tucker?
Yes, it is. And in fact, we actually do educational programs to make sure that people understand how to do that process. We offer those on a monthly basis. So anybody who wants to hunt pythons can sign up and take one of those classes. You may have had a similar class prior to going out on the python hunt that you did. So that's available to the public. So anybody would know how to effectively and humanely kill them.
Members, did anyone else on the committee do the python challenge? Did anyone else get one? Now, I understand Representative Alvarez, Representative Porras also.
He did.
Now, who got the larger python?
Well, that night, they may have been intimidated by how many people were out there, so. No answer?
Fair enough. Ranking member, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you. One more question. And it's in the same vein of education and outreach, not for the organizations that you're already working with, but the individual homeowner or the friend with a gun. You know, what are the consequences for not killing it humanely, not disposing of it properly? How are you managing that? And if we're not managing that, what's the point?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So the laws that are related to cruelty are not FWC laws. Those are state statute, and so they can be enforced by any law enforcement agency.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Member.
So if I have a neighbor who I suspect of inhumanely killing the iguanas or pythons or anything for that matter, I call you?
Ms. Tucker.
You could call us or you could call your sheriff's office or your police department.
Any but not 911. You wouldn't recommend 911.
I would not.
Okay. I want to make sure when we're talking about the police department or the sheriff's, we're not talking about 911, escalating a situation that we don't need to. And so in follow-up to the education outreach question, can you tell us a little bit about what that looks like in terms of how individuals are able to access that information? Is it they have to actively go and look for it on your website, or is there outreach?
Ms. Tucker?
So there's a combination of both. There are outreach opportunities. We provide social media posts and other things that let people know about it. And then in the interim, when those social media posts aren't active, then people would search for it and be able to find it on our website as well.
Representative Bartleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up, because I've had an iguana chase my chihuahua. That's how bad iguanas are in my neighborhood. If I go to your app, will I know how to, does it, not your app, your site, and I was gonna suggest maybe an app, especially for people who live in South Florida, like the one picture you showed, I'm pretty sure I've seen one of those in my backyard, and I didn't even know that was an invasive species, and I just ran away from it pretty much and got my Chihuahua. So my question is, will it tell you how to humanely do that? Because I don't think people know. Like, I see people running around with, like, a shovel. I've done that personally. But can you tell us, for a snake, can you tell us on that app, will it give us ways to do this the correct way? Because it's a huge, Everglades is 5 minutes from my house, so probably we should have never been built there. So I have a lot of these critters. So can you elaborate on that, please?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So the I've Got One app is truly just a reporting mechanism. It's a way to tell us that you have something that you suspect is a non-native species and you'd like for us to look into it. And again, it doesn't go just to the FWC. This is a multi-agency reporting app that goes to multiple entities. Information on how to humanely kill things is available on our website. So that would be a separate area to look than the I've Got One app.
Representative Alvarez.
I'm sorry, one more follow-up. Because of my Python expertise now, I'm all into this. So it occurred to me, like, after we were studying this and I legit got into it just trying to figure out, like, we have people with, you know, there's the wonder about they're running around with guns, they've got shovels, traps. I looked up something called an Iggy trap, and it was really a neat solution. I'm not pushing any product or anything. Have you all ever heard of that, ever considered traps like that? If so, is that part of the solution as well?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So we have heard of the Iggy traps, and we're very intrigued by them and how they seem to be working. I think that we have looked at a variety of techniques, and we've put a lot of funding into figuring out multiple different options, because there is probably no one single option. It's going to take a suite of tools in different habitats and areas in order to effectively remove something like iguanas.
Representative Alvarez.
Is there something that we could do to help you be more successful? Is there something that you need, or is there something that FWC could get some support from the House or the legislature?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
I would actually say that you have been incredibly helpful to us already. We received additional recurring funding last year, and we're actively using that and truly appreciate the support and the recognition that you have brought to the issue of invasive species.
Ms. Tucker, just jumping back to the pythons for a minute, I had read somewhere and then subsequently heard on a podcast somewhere in the neck of the woods, between 99% of small fur-bearing mammals in the Everglades have been eradicated. Is that number, do you believe that number might be correct?
I've seen some of that research, and I think that the number is large. I'm not sure if that's exactly what it is. We could certainly go back, and I'll double-check the references to see. But it's,
yeah, and just to follow up on that, a large portion of the geography we're talking about, we're talking about Everglades National Park, which is a federal park. What are some of the restrictions as it relates to, for the general public or anyone else, as it relates to addressing the invasive species issue like the python in a national park?
So national parks are going to have their own set of rules, and the general public is not going to be able to remove from those areas. We did sign an executive order earlier this year that made sure that we had 32 of FWC's managed lands that are open, and people can go on those and remove pythons. There's no license or hunting licenses that are required for you to do that.
And as you know, they're very truly elusive, these pythons. What are some of the best tools currently in the toolbox as it relates to addressing and managing this invasive species?
We're hopeful that the infrared cameras will be an option for us moving forward, because again, the habitat that they're in is very difficult to move through. It's very difficult to see things that are out there. And so that infrared technology would be very helpful in identifying the presence of the animals. Right now, a lot of the work is done along levees and roadways. And so they're doing cruising at night, looking for animals that are actually up on those levees. And so the drones in particular would give us a lot of ability to get out away from the levees and to search more areas.
Ms. Tucker, and the drones, that's something that's currently being deployed?
That's something that we're working on, a research project right now to see the efficacy, how well that's working.
I had also read on the FWC website about a Python detector dog program. Can you share with us the extent of which that's been successful? And I've anecdotally heard that, you know, when trained properly, it can be a very effective tool as it relates to finding, you know, some of these that are burrowed in or difficult, that might be otherwise difficult to the human eye.
So the detector dogs are a useful tool. They tend to work best when you know that there's a python in the area and you can and they can help track you to that specific location. As far as like moving dogs across a large area where you're not sure if the pythons are at, again, it's very hard habitat to move through. The dogs are only allowed to work a certain amount of time every day. And so it's not as effective for searching when you don't know that an animal's there. But when you know an animal's there and you're just not sure exactly where it's at, then they're much more effective at narrowing in on the location.
So the dog program, is that something that's also being employed by contractors?
I believe that we have a contract for the detector dogs, but I don't know that any of our Python contractors are using dogs.
But they're able to use dogs?
They could.
Okay. And then as it relates to, is there any currently regulatory barriers or anything else, you know, that's perhaps causing an issue as it relates to addressing and managing some of these invasive species such as the python?
I think that's a question we'd probably like to think about. I'm not aware of any in the short term, but we can certainly discuss it as a team and see if there's something that we come up with.
And as it relates to the general public and engagement, I think the Python Challenge and what you and South Florida Water Management District that you're doing with that is great. Is there anything else that we could be doing in terms of reaching out and getting more of the general public's involvement as it relates to this, or perhaps, you know, working with nonprofits or others to leverage some of our resources?
I think that there are many opportunities for us to continue to work with private and public partners to help advertise the work that we're doing and make sure that the public understands that they can have a role in removal of invasive species and that they understand how to do it. So I do think that it's something that we as an agency can continue to work on and to work on with our partners.
And as it relates to contractors and folks in the field, do you think we currently have enough folks, including contractors, general public, and otherwise, to begin to put a dent in what we're seeing with this explosive python population and iguana population?
I think that we have many very professional contractors that are out there, and they're very effective at removing pythons. We can always use more people and more eyes to identify where they're at.
So from your standpoint, is it more... Are some of these contractors hard to come by in terms of, is this something that we're actively recruiting, or is it more of a bottleneck as it relates to funds available?
We do actively recruit. We do not have a funding issue right now. For many of the contractors, this is a part-time job for them. It's not their full-time job, so it's something that they may do and enjoy in the evenings or on the weekends. There are other individuals who do it full-time, and there's just a lot of variety there. And we want that program to fit all of those options so that people can do it part-time or they can do it full-time.
Members, do we have any other questions? Representative Botana.
Yeah, one question. Thank you, Chair. How long, we go back to the pythons with the dogs, how long does the dogs work? I mean, do you have any information on that?
I'd have to double-check.
Okay, thank you.
Members, questions? Okay, I did have one or two more. Would it ever make, is it something that's been contemplated, and would it be something worth considering or looking into as it relates to perhaps, and I know there's a system as it relates to contractors, but more or less a bounty type system on some of these invasive species, including the python?
That is,
or the general public?
That is something that we've talked about and considered. We have not moved forward with it.
How many drop centers do we have across the state? So if you have an if you have a pet that is invasive and you want to drop it off somewhere, how many do we have across the state? And has that, and how long has that program been in existence for, and has it been successful?
So the Exotic Pet Amnesty Program began in 2006, and it's actually evolved over time. We actually don't have any centers where people are dropping off their animals. In the early days, we did Exotic Pet Amnesty Day, and people would come and adopters would come, and they would bring their animals, and the people who were interested in taking those animals, we would match them up. So it's a little bit like we're a matchmaking service. More recently, we do our Exotic Pet Amnesty Days, but we also do online matching. And so somebody can come in and they can apply to be an adopter, or they can apply and say, I've got this animal and I'd like to be able to rehome it. And then we match them up with someone. So we never actually take possession of the animals. We just match the two people together, and then we make sure that the animal is, the transfer happens.
So there's no longer any physical locations?
There are no physical locations.
Okay. Members, questions? Questions? Rep. Bartleman.
Thank you, Chair, but you asked some really good questions, so I'm trying to figure out.
I'm trying to get everyone stimulated here.
You got me thinking. Well, because my question is, I'm trying to think of this as a Floridian, right? I don't know what's invasive, or plants especially, but even some of the animals here today. So I would have to call you, and I have this thing in my backyard. You're not coming out to get it. So where do you go from there? And then if I am going to kill it, I'm going to have to try to navigate your website to figure that out. And then if I catch it, I don't have a place to, like your drop-off question, like what am I going to do with it? So if the idea is, especially with the ones that, what's the lizard you spoke of? The one that, what's
the monitor?
That one scares me if that was in my
the Nile.
Yeah. So I was wondering, how can you make it more user-friendly for a Floridian so they can identify, and then even if we call, what are you doing? And then am I stuck holding this in a box? Like, can you go into that? Because it's not practical for us. So,
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So the I've Got One app is the first point of contact in making sure that we're aware of what you've got, and then we can help you identify it from there. So somebody can contact you and let you know what it was. From that point, depending on what it is, if it's one of those high priority species, like you had a monitor like that in your yard, then that is something that we might want to come out and actually remove, because it's a species of high concern for us. If you had an agama, you know, something that's more common, and it's a much smaller species with less impact, we probably wouldn't want to come out. If you wanted to remove it, then you would have the ability to catch it. You could either put it in a trap, or you could just catch it by hand, and then you could kill it. Or some people hire an outside contractor to come in. So we have a list of businesses that are on our website that actually do that removal service for people.
Ranking Member Skidmore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do the contractors do with the carcasses?
Ms. Tucker.
They have they have to euthanize them, but they are also able to keep the carcass and use it. So there are some individuals that, you know, in the case of pythons, that are actually going to keep the skin and use it for making something. But it just depends on the individual contractor, but they all have to euthanize the animal.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
Thank you. But practically speaking, if individuals aren't killing the iguanas in their yards and then spending God knows how many hours digging a grave and burying it, the contractors certainly aren't. So they're going along, going to however many different residences or commercial places, killing iguanas. Now they've got like a truckload. So what are they doing with those carcasses? Are they selling them for meat? Are they, again, throwing them to alligators? And how are we supposed to educate our Floridians about how to do this safely, humanely, logically, if there really doesn't seem to be a lot of outreach or public service announcements about it? And I get that, you know, from Orlando up, it's not an issue for anybody. But in South Florida, at my job, you know, we come out and our cars are covered in iguana, because they're all in the trees. They are the chicken of the trees. So what is the advice that we should be giving to our constituents? And what is FWC, what is the plan for disseminating the best information and not just having this passive website where people have to figure out how and navigate it by themselves?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So I think there's two separate questions that you asked there. One is specific to the contractors. And so the contractors are able to use the animals as they will. And so we do hear of some that sell them to other, once they've been euthanized, sell them for meat for other things. And they use skins. On the private constituent component, then I think that as I mentioned earlier, like providing a little bit more of that education and outreach is something that we can certainly do. We do social media campaigns. We do iHeart campaigns that are often targeted to specific neighborhoods to let people know about what their options are. And we can continue to do that and to do it at increased frequencies.
Representative Steele with the question.
Thank you, Chair. Great questioning. I do have kind of a couple of recommendations and then also a question. Maybe you can put like a website and have an adopt person in that geographical area that would be willing to go out there and take those animals that needed to be taken out, not necessarily a contractor, because it sounds like anybody can, there's no license for it, right?
Ms. Tucker?
Our contractors are signed up, but any individual can remove an iguana.
So maybe you can have like a list that people are putting their name on to go out to those locations to help eradicate the species.
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So we do have a list on our website of people who are commercial businesses that remove iguanas.
I'm just talking about like individuals.
Individuals.
Yeah. And then, you know, I've seen where, and because I actually go down and do iguana hunts, and so, but I've seen people actually come out and harass the people that are licensed to do this or have a relationship to do this, and they're feeding the animal, so it's like their own pet. What is FWC doing about that?
Ms. Tucker.
I think that's good information for us to have. If someone is feeding an animal in a way that it becomes a nuisance, then that is something that our law enforcement will typically look into, so reporting that to us is important.
Members, questions? Representative Cassell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for indulging us in answering our questions. Being a South Florida representative, I personally I woke up one morning to 20 baby iguanas in my patio, and when I called one of those contractors, the cost to handle that was pretty large. I mean, it was $20 per iguana to remove. Are there any programs available or preferred vendors or grant programs that if an everyday Floridian wakes up, has that same situation, can't bear that cost, that they can contact FWC, they're not paying out of their own pocket? Is that something that's available? Do you have preferred vendors? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So we have a list of vendors that are available on our website. We do not necessarily have preferred vendors. As a state agency, we need to make sure that we're completely fair in the way that we represent anybody who signed up to do this. The question of whether or not we can offer grants, we've talked about whether or not there's a grant to municipalities or something that we could do. That is something, you know, when you asked about the legislative opportunities, we would need funding in a grant program in order to be able to push out money in that way.
Ms. Tucker, and this is something certain local governments and municipalities are already doing. In
terms of investing and bringing in contractors to address some of these invasives, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Cheney, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair Buchanan. Thank you for your presentation. So do I understand correctly that there are these invasive species are sold in, like, pet stores, and then owners have them, and they either escape or they let them loose, and then the taxpayer funds your programs to go get them and remove them? Is that what's happening?
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
I'll make a distinction between a non-native species and an invasive species. So there are species that are absolutely being sold as pets, and people have them as pets. Not all of those would become invasive. We do have a list of species that are both prohibited and conditional. And so the species that we feel are at the highest risk of becoming invasive are on that prohibited list, and you cannot have those as a personal pet. We also have the conditional species list, which people cannot have that set of species as a conditional, as a personal pet either. So iguanas are species that you no longer are able to have as a personal pet in the state of Florida. So there shouldn't be anybody that's selling them to the public.
Follow up. Are they being imported from other areas?
Ms. Tucker?
No, you're not able to import them and have them as a pet.
Ms. Tucker, and along that same vein, I had also read somewhere about it. What about this idea, and I know it's something that's currently not being done, but looking at places such as Florida, where we have a tropical environment, and, you know, the iguana, the python issue, and many others, perhaps making it more of a free market where you know, folks would have the opportunity to come in and sell these to states and other places where they wouldn't be, it wouldn't be an opportunity for them to be invasive. Like up north, a lot of these, both of them could not exist. So is that something that's been done, considered, contemplated?
So when I mentioned the Exotic Pet Amnesty Program, we do have people from all across the country that are signed up to be adopters within that program. We also, iguanas are not able to be maintained as a personal pet, but that was a fairly recent move that we made in 2021 to add iguanas to the prohibited species list. Because there were so many iguanas that were already in pet ownership, and there were places in Florida that were breeding them, those individual places, there's a sunsetting period where they won't be able to breed, but they will be able to continue to collect from the wild and ship out of state. So it's a very limited number of people that will have that opportunity, because we don't want to increase the business that's around collecting these animals from the wild. The concern there is that you end up with people unintentionally farming the animals, leaving enough out there that they continue to breed, and you have animals that are in the wild continuously to take from the wild.
Okay. Members, any other questions? We do have one more presentation. Ms. Tucker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very insightful. Members, up next, we'll be hearing from South Florida Water Management District Executive Director Drew Bartlett. Mr. Bartlett, you're recognized to present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to stand up here and be able to share with you some of the experiences we have executing our mission in South Florida as it relates to exotic species and their impact to our mission. With me, I've got Leroy Rogers, who is our expert in exotics control, and he will be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. We look forward to it.
All right. First of all, so I come at it more from a local government perspective, where we have a specific mission to execute. And our mission in South Florida Water Management District is three-pronged. Ecosystem restoration, you've all heard of Everglades restoration, protecting our communities from flooding, and meeting the region's water supply needs. So as part of that mission, we have two canals, pump stations, storage devices, that manage water and move water around the system for the public and for the environment. And you can see here pictures of a pump station with water hyacinth choking the intake of the pump station. You see a canal with hydrilla topped out. That doesn't convey water. That doesn't execute our flood control mission. So we have to deploy our activities to make sure that, that we can continue to execute our mission. And then, of course, we have our ecosystem restoration mission. And here you have an Everglades marsh and what it should look like. But then the Melaleuca invasion can occur in the Everglades at any given moment. And that's an aerial shot of Melaleuca trees coming into the Everglades marsh. And so we have to work to make sure that ecosystem stays what we want, which is the Everglades marsh. So I'll talk to you a bit about that as well. As far as areas of responsibility, the Southwater Water Management District has 2,600 miles of canals that we have to monitor and maintain, 430,000 acres of lakes, 78,000 acres of treatment wetlands that we use to clean the water, that if it gets invaded by exotic or invasive plants, then we cannot treat the water like we used to. And then, of course, we have our conservation lands in South Florida, 1.6 million acres of that. My presentation is going to be more focused on plants, because that's what really can disrupt our mission, as you can tell. So we do have invasive animals that do have impacts. We do have levees, 2,000 miles of levees that need to hold water in a certain space. Putting a home by an iguana home inside that levee is not something we would want. It really damages the integrity of that levee. So our inspection programs looks for these and removes them and fills that hole. And of course, our ecosystem restoration mission is impacted by the python. So let's talk about plants. And of course, every exotic plant thing that you are undertaking starts with prevention. The job that FWC does on plants and education and regulation and everything is very much appreciated by us. We partner for this effort, the public education efforts, on many different fronts. But when it comes to plants, this is an example of how you can take water lettuce, the exotic water lettuce, from one lake, it gets caught on a trailer and transported to another lake. So that can happen with a lot of vehicles. If you're in a seed bank of an invasive grass, you can move it to another location. And so when we manage it through our contractors and through our field stations. There is a cleansing practice that we do on all of our vehicles to prevent this hitchhiking of invasive plants from one place to the other on the district. But every once in a while, we have to deal with it with a real infestation, if you will. But that is what we use, what is called an integrated pest management. And that is not, there's just not one technique. It uses all these different techniques to control an invasive species. Mechanical, we all understand, using equipment to remove it. Chemical, you spray it, you kill it, and it can't spread. There's cultural practices. That's like the farming practices that have happened over the centuries, like prescribed fire, like water management to try to control invasive plants. And then we introduce biological species. These are species, after a decade of research, that come from the native habitat, that in the native habitat, they keep it under control. Whereas when it gets into South Florida, it can spread. And so this is a thrips, and it is for the control of the Melaleuca tree, which you see in the bottom there. So it eats the Melaleuca. And then, of course, there's always the public engagement and education to try to help control it. So let's talk about how it's executed. On the left here, you have a Melaleuca tree stand in the Everglades, right? That is not what the Everglades is supposed to look like. And so the sequencing of this integrated pest management is it can take many different forms, but this is just one example, is where you chop the tree, you treat the stump so it won't regrow, right, using herbicide. Then, after that settles for a bit, dries out, you hit it with the prescribed fire. And then as the plants and the Melaleuca saplings are weakened by the prescribed fire, you can release your thrips to chew on it, keep it from spreading, keep it from proliferating using a biological control. And then you get into the maintenance phase where you can go by, spot treat it, hand pull it, those types of things in a healthy ecosystem. The whole goal of the South Florida Water Management District with these plants is getting it to maintenance control, not invasive, not invaded, but but maintenance. So it's the natural ecosystem. So we use this integrated pest management to get there. And here's before and after picture in the Everglades for where in water conservation areas 3B, which is what we own and manage, we use this Melaleuca treatment, that cycle I just explained. And so you see the before and after. You have little sprigs of Melaleuca coming up, but you can just fly through it with an airboat, pull them, or if you can't pull them, spot treat them. And by the way, the legislature is very generous. They fund this Melaleuca control program through Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission to us, and we put our own funds in. So it's a very successful program that we love to brag about in South Florida. This is what it does. I want to talk about data and numbers and that kind of stuff, too, of the importance of getting to maintenance control. So this is Lake Okeechobee. And you see the before picture in the upper right, that's a Melaleuca tree stand in Lake Okeechobee, not natural, not native vegetation. And so you undergo an effort where you put significant costs and investment year by year to try to do what I just described to get the Melaleuca stand under control. And then when it's under control, you can see the invasion, infestations, the red line, is completely infested down to not, right? And you see the cost per year, which is very expensive, down to very little. We have a side-by-side comparison as well. So you have Water Conservation Area 1, which is Everglades. That's a federal refuge, the Loxahatchee Refuge. It's still going through the integrated pest management to try to get invasive plants under control. The rest of the water conservation areas in the central Everglades is under control, so that we have finished the job to get it into maintenance control on the Water Conservation Area 3A. Look at the cost difference, right? So you have a little over 20,000 acres of refuge, but you're using to try to get it under control 3,243 gallons of herbicide for that refuge, about $40 an acre to try to get under control. But once you accomplish the goal, on the right side, you've got a 100,000-plus acre water conservation area. For the whole 100,000 plus acres, we only use about 295 gallons per year for the saplings that are coming up. It's a 99% cost savings once you get it to maintenance. So you have not only a healthy ecosystem, but your costs are way lower, right? So that's the goal. We have launched an effort in the Picayune Strand Forest. This is a Everglades restoration, 55,000 acre Everglades Restoration Initiative in Collier County, where they are retrofitting. You know, it was platted, dug, developed for a subdivision, but now it's getting restored back to a wetland community, incredible panther habitat, once we get the exotics under control. So we've launched that control program, and you can see where we started from the east side going to the west side, methodically taking out the Brazilian pepper and the Kogan grass invasive species, and there's a couple others too, to try to get back to its natural vegetation so it's useful for the panther, useful for all the native wildlife. That right now is costing us about $3.1 million per year as we try to get it to maintenance control. But once we get it to maintenance control, it's not that, not even close to that. And it's good for the environment, right? So that's the ecosystem restoration mission, right? So that's our experience in how we tackle the invasive plants. But on the flood control side, here you have a canal on the left. And after Hurricane Andrew, basically all those were Australian pines, another invasive tree that they cannot hold up in a hurricane. So after Hurricane Andrew, they all get blown into the canal, right? What you want on your canal if you're doing a flood control mission is on the right, where you don't have those Australian pines ready to get toppled into the canal, get caught against bridges, get caught, hit your water control structures, and really cause a problem, right? So this is a picture, a little movie, after Hurricane Ian went through Lee County, where the district part, you know, said, we can help here. So he went out to 10 Mile Canal in Lee County, where it had these Australian pines on the side that blew in. And so fortunately, we didn't get a rain event after Hurricane Ian in Lee County, but we were able to remove those Australian pines because if we did get a rain event, they could cause a real problem with conveyance and flood control in that county. So that's what we do for our conveyance maintenance. with our canals. You heard a lot about the pythons. This is the graph for our python removal program with our python hunters. Great partnership with Florida Fish and Wildlife. I really don't need to cover this. You covered it well. One of the things we're trying with FWC and University of Florida is basically trying to get attractants in there to bait pythons, if you will. It's very experimental right now. We use rabbits. They are not harmed. They are in the cages, very cute. If you want to adopt one after we're done, they're available to you. But we're experimenting with attracting the python and then removing it with an attractant. We're not only just with live rabbits, but also rabbit bedding, you know, pellets, anything like that, to see if it's possible. So one of the things about getting to maintenance control is it saves costs. And in particular in South Florida Water Management District, we monitor that very closely. And the herbicide use that we've been, because of our efforts at getting there, has gone down drastically over time, not only from getting to maintenance control, but also for some research that we're doing to try to have different alternatives basically using herbicide. And like we have our mechanical harvester, but we also have released sterile grass carb. Ms. Barlowman, you may remember this. So that's a tanker truck of smaller grass carp that we can deploy in our canals. They're sterile. They cannot reproduce. They have to be between structures, but they eat the hydrilla, right? And so, you know, it's a biological control that we deploy to make sure that we have good conveyance in our canals, because hydrilla will certainly impact that. And then another way to try to save costs is reducing the herbicide use. On the left, you see the traditional approach to Brazilian pepper, where you just spray the base of the tree and it takes out the tree. And now we're experimenting with a hack method, where you just cut the base of the tree and you squirt a little bit of herbicide in the base of the tree. And that cuts down the herbicide use by like 97% and absolutely kills the tree. It's a very effective approach that we're still deploying and experimenting with. So I've covered a lot of the basics on how we deal with our mission and the exotics that really impact our mission, particularly with respect to plants. If you have any questions, Mr. Chair, I'm sure Mr. Rogers would be happy to answer them.
Thank you for that presentation, Mr. Bartlett. Members, questions? Representative Barlman.
I just want to make a comment. Thank you, Chair, because I was there at the fish release because I didn't realize the invasive plant that was in the canals in my area. And it was amazing to see. And I thought it was just so environmentally friendly for you to do that, because some people would have just sprayed something, and instead you did something the right way to protect the canal and my environment and my neighborhood. Actually, we weren't even near my neighborhood at that point. We were way out. But it was amazing what you do, and I just want to let you know that I do appreciate all the work you do, especially in my area where we have a lot of inland floating, and I just can't thank you enough, and thank you for this presentation. So I really just want to let you know how much I appreciate you, and thank you for educating me. So thank you.
Members, questions? Representative Cheney.
Thank you, Chair Buchanan. Thank you for the presentation. In my district, we had a situation where FWC came in and did a plan for floodplain management and runoff, because this body of water that you helped us create for flood management goes directly into Boca Ciega Bay. Mm. So it was important that we had, you know, proper cleansing of the water before it went into the bay, and you did a great job building it and then turned it over to the city to manage. And unfortunately, the city didn't have any properly trained or skilled lake management people on staff. They just used their engineers. And fast forward a couple of years, and the lake is full of invasive species. It's a big mess. And to me, it seems like we probably need to require some kind of skilled lake management folks in place. Do you have any comments or suggestions how to prevent those kind of situations from happening? Because now we're chasing after these invasive species.
Mr. Bartlett, you're recognized.
Yeah, that's an unfortunate story. And it does take skilled eyes and a proactive approach, because it can get out of control extremely quickly. And there are tools, and there are lake managers, there are professional lake managers that know how to keep it under control. My staff does it all the time, but if you don't stay on top of it, you'll lose control, and then you're in a real expensive situation to try to get it back to where you wanted it. So it is a skill. We know how to do it, but you have to do it. And we've got 100,000 lakes in Florida, right? So it's something to keep an eye on.
Members, questions? You spent a good deal of time on the presentation talking about invasive aquatics and plants. Melaleuca was brought up a few times. Can you share with us the history on that?
On the Melaleuca?
Yeah, the introduction.
So it really started with Everglades restoration, and when we saw the infestation in the Everglades with the Melaleuca stands, and they're kind of on the edge of the Everglades in some private properties, but they'll seed into the Everglades and just grow into a forest. So it was one of the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan components, SERP components, was eradicate the Melaleuca and get it under control. And so, I mean, it's folks like the staff that we had that partnered with a Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission to deploy these integrated pest management techniques. Honestly, it takes a steady investment. It's like in Picayune Strand, I have to set aside $3 million a year to make it happen in Picayune Strand, and that's what we had to do in the Everglades as well. So it takes that big upfront investment, but then once it's under control, it's not expensive to maintain.
But in terms of how it was introduced, do we know that?
Oh, Melaleuca?
Yeah.
So it's my understanding that back in the days when we were trying to reclaim the land and remove the water, Melaleuca is a very fast-growing tree, as you can tell, and it was very good at removing water off the landscape. And so if you were trying to remove water off the landscape, one of the practices was you plant some Melaleuca trees, it dries out the land a bit better so you can use it for whatever purpose you had interest in using. It was not a decorative. It was more of an engineered biological solution at the time.
Yeah. It's a cautionary tale, right?
That's right.
Just wanted to ask you just a question as it relates to the chemical herbicide treatments. Do the invasives gain a tolerance over time to treatment?
This is where I will refer to Mr. Rogers, who has much more experience in that, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'll make sure he fills out a card.
Thank you for the question, and it's a good one. Resistance to herbicides does happen. It has happened in agriculture particularly. So that's something that we're very mindful of. This is one reason that when we are using herbicides, sometimes we will switch the herbicide, the active ingredient, around so that we're not repeatedly using the same active ingredient on a species that might suddenly evolve into a resistant form. So it happens. We have not seen it in any of our programs to date.
I'll just have one follow-up for you. So over time, are we using, it seems like we have a pretty well-rounded approach with a variety of different methods. Are we on the whole using less than previously, or compared to mechanical or one of the biological or one of the others that you mentioned?
Yes, as Drew mentioned, we are on the whole using less, but that's primarily due to the fact that we are achieving maintenance control on much of our lands. We've always used integrated management techniques where we combine mechanical control or prescribed fire. I think most of the decline that we're seeing in our active ingredient use decline is due to achieving maintenance control. We just have less vegetation to control.
Thank you for that. Members, questions? Representative Steele.
I actually have two. You talked about sterilizing the carp, but what about the bug?
You're recognized.
Thank you. The insects that we use for biological control are carefully tested over a number of years in quarantine, starting overseas. We have a very strong partnership with USDA Agricultural Research Service. Scientists will find insects that are so tightly co-evolved with the targeted plant that they literally will not feed or complete their life cycle on any other plant but the targeted invasive plant. So we go through a lot of rigorous testing to check that, make sure that the plant won't hop to maybe an agricultural plant of interest. For example, Brazilian pepper is in the same family as mango, so we wouldn't want to bring an insect that would jump to our mango trees. So it takes very rigorous testing to do that. Then once it's proven overseas that it's not jumping over, we'll do further testing here at the quarantine facility in Davie, Florida that the USDA ARS operates and we help fund. So at this point, that's what we call classical biological control, where we very carefully test. We have not had any case where there's been a hop, if you will, of an insect on an unintended target.
Representative Steele, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I don't know how you'd confirm. That's awesome. So I live on a lake in Pasco County, and they come by and spray, but when they do that, it kills what's there, but it leaves, you know, a very nutrient-rich spot, you know, for something else to grow. And cattails have gotten, you know, completely out of control on the lake. We didn't have the issue, you know, before they started spraying. What are your thoughts around that?
You're recognized.
Thank you. A good question. Cattail, of course, is a native species, but under certain disturbance regimes, usually under elevated nutrients or altered hydrology or some sort of ground disturbance, you can see cattail become what we call a nuisance species. And that's occurring in the Everglades and throughout Florida, frankly, because our waters are generally elevated in nutrients relative to, you know, 200 years ago. It's possible. I'm not sure about your particular case. I'd have to look at it specifically, but there are cases where, due to those elevated nutrients, if you open it up, you take one invasive species out, another one, in this case cattail, would come in and take its place.
Members, questions? Representative Bartleman.
Thank you, Chair. I guess this is an overall question for both agencies. There's so many little things that we can do as Floridians that will make a difference. Like, for instance, the plants from the fish tanks that people dump into the canals that then destroy the canals. In terms of the animals, letting your iguanas loose or letting your turtles loose or your exotic pet, have you thought about doing something at the school level, some sort of informational environmental stewardship for young children, like working together? Because when my kids were little and they brought home any kind of information, they go, "Mom, you can't do that. I learned that in school." And I just think there are things that are common sense that people don't know, because I wouldn't think that dumping a fish tank in a canal would actually destroy the ecosystem in the canal. So have you thought of doing anything with the DOE to try to create environmental stewards for Florida on things that are important to Florida?
Mr. Bartlett, you're recognized.
So I will turn it over to Ms. Tucker, because, but obviously, isn't it just a nice thing when your kid comes home and they know more than you, right? So it, you know, we certainly want to put together the materials, you know, work on a curriculum, anything like that to try to help start that next generation education. I mean, it's something we would look at very carefully. I don't know if you have anything to add.
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
So we do have our Florida Youth Conservation Center network, and they have a module that's been developed around invasive species and being good stewards that they do teach to the kids that come to the center, and then it can be exported into classrooms and other things.
Follow up.
Can you let me know how many school districts are actually utilizing it and how the penetration of that? Because I think that's really... I think that should be a key, because a lot of the stuff we do here that happens here in Florida in terms of environment, we create. So I would love to see that go to all counties and get to every classroom to make sure that students know. And then they can come home and tell me what I'm doing wrong. Well, my future grandchildren, my children are old now. But I love it when I hear kids talk about how to take care of Florida and how to take care of our ecosystem. So thank you.
Ms. Tucker, you're recognized.
Well, I'll go back and check on that. That's a completely different program from mine.
Members, questions? Anyone have anything left? Mr. Bartlett, thank you very much.
Thank you,
very
Mr.
informative.
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Rogers. It's great to have people smarter than you.
Thank you both. I want to thank both of our presenters. It was very informative, as you could tell. We had a lot of questions, and it was a subject matter which we all had a lot of interest in. So thank you very much for your participation. And I know there's a few follow-up items, and we'll look forward to hearing from you guys on that. And I want to thank the committee members. You guys did a great job today. It was a very productive day in this committee. And is before we close out, is there any other closing remarks anyone wants to make? Rep. Alvarez, you want to talk about that Python anymore, or are you good?
No, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate it. I think we're Pythoned out.
Representative Asada.
Thank you. I was just going to say, if you have not done a tour with the Water Management District, they do an amazing job, so I highly recommend it, and it's very informative, but it's a great way to see everything that they do and to see our state, so top of the list.
Representative Bartleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for facilitating great conversation. And since we're not going to see her tomorrow, Rep. Cassell's birthday is tomorrow. So happy birthday, Rep. Cassell.
Happy birthday, Rep. Cassell. Members, and before we close out, one last thing I wanted to say. At some point, and I will get everyone the dates, Representative Bartleman's been great in terms of our legislative trail ride, but we've started to do that again annually. In the coming weeks, we'll begin to get some dates for that. It's up here in Tallahassee. It'll be hopefully on a light day, and everything will be provided, the bikes, everything you need. So we'll get you more details as it relates to that as we get closer. Seeing no further business before the committee, Ranking Member Skidmore moves we rise without objection.